committee has come to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Considine moves the minutes from February 28, 2017. Any corrections or additions to those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from February 28th, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The minutes from February 28th are adopted. House File 921, Representative Keel, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 921 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Keel, do you have any amendments?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't believe I do.
I think I see an A1 amendment. Looks like a technical amendment. Is that in your bag?
Yes. Oh, okay. Oh, I'm aware
that. I'll read the amendment that I have, A1, and you can see if that's what you want to do. Page 1, line 17, before the insert, this is a one-time appropriation and. Does that sound right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Keel moves adoption of the... Oh, I'm sorry. I will move adoption of the A1 amendment. Discussion to the A1 amendment. All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Keel, the House File 921 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill does two things. It modifies the treatment of vacant beds, therapeutic leave days for residents, and it also does some work with the home and community-based services, and that's a study based on a consolidation study. Excuse me. And I am going to have my testifier explain this bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Barb Turner with ARMS, and this bill does two different things unrelated to each other, but both having financial impact. So the first section of the bill has to do with ICF, MRIDs, and the treatment of open beds in regards to payment. So it's an antiquated language that was put in place years ago when ICFs were first being developed in order to incent providers to fill current beds before they developed new beds. And what the language does is says that after 30 days of having a vacant bed, a provider can no longer bill for therapeutic leave days for anyone else in the facility for the remainder of that calendar year. So therapeutic leave days are for things like vacations, visiting family, those sorts of things. And so now, in current day, there's the only reason that there are open beds is because no one's chosen to live there. Providers aren't trying not to fill a bed. So in the way it works now, they're kind of damaged in two ways. They don't receive payment for the bed that hasn't been filled, and then they aren't able to bill after 30 days into the calendar year for anyone else who goes home or goes on vacation, those sorts of things. And this is especially impactful on rural providers because they often sit with open beds in some towns that people aren't necessarily choosing to move out to, and so the ability to fill their beds is sometimes a little more challenging. So this language would allow those beds to be considered reserved rather than vacant, and that would allow providers to be able to bill for therapeutic leave days. And the second section of the bill is an allocation of money for the department to do a study on the consolidation of the four disability waivers. And as a representative of providers, we feel that this could be beneficial and potentially a cost-saving measure because it would simplify and perhaps streamline how we do services under all of the disability waivers. Because currently there are things you can get under one and not under another, and having to keep kind of track of what you can and can't do, and sometimes just depending on which waiver someone lands on limits something that they might have the opportunity to choose as a service. So that's the two components of this bill.
All right. Questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I did have a chance to talk to Ms. Turner about this, but I just think that we as a committee need to start thinking long-term about this area. We're going to see a lot more change on it just because of the Olmstead lawsuit settlement and the plan that requires us to get more people moving on to increased independence and integration in their housing situation. And for counties who've really worked hard to help people explore options, moving out to a less dependent situation, one of their number one fears is that they can't go back home. That if they could try a more independent living service with, you know, maybe a SIL support or some other supports, and it doesn't work out for them, by the time they decide they can't handle it, their bed has been filled. They can't go back to what was perhaps a long-time home. And so I'm hoping that, you know, as we move on, we look at how to better help people through these transitions, because they're going to be really important, and the industry's figuring out how to deal with that as well. It's going to be a long-term change for our system, and just wanted to say that's an issue that's probably going to come back in a different way. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, further questions or final wrap-up, Representative Keel?
Please support the bill.
All right. With that, Representative Keel, House File 921 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you for bringing the, as amended, thank you for bringing the bill before us, Representative. Thank you, Ms. Turner.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Keel.
I don't mean to interrupt your committee, but I just wanted to make comment that we have some University of Minnesota students from Crookston here.
Excellent.
And amongst them, I think, is Chair Dean's daughter. Or did she disappear?
She's
somewhere else. Oh.
I think she's chairing another committee.
There you go. Anyway, I'm very proud to say that they've traveled down for the day to see how we work in the legislature.
Long bus ride. Thanks for coming from all parts of the University of Minnesota. Thank you, Representative Keel. And we do have one committee announcement. There was some chocolates passed around. I believe it is Representative Franson's 34th birthday today. Happy birthday, Representative Franson. All right. Now, what's that? Okay. All right. Next up, we have Representative Peterson, House File 737. Welcome to the committee. I will move House File 737 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. I understand you have an A1 amendment. I will go ahead and move the A1 amendment. Representative Peterson, so if you could describe that, we will incorporate that and then go to your bill. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment is from Department of Human Services, and it's more technical in nature to help implement the program, and that's why we have the amendment.
All right. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson to the 921 as amended.
House File 737. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, House File 737 is a creation of a mental health innovation grant fund. I had the privilege this summer of serving with Dr. Suter here on the Governor's Mental Health Task Force. And I have been interested in this topic for quite some time, as well as it affects my family personally. But I learned a lot on the task force, and some of the takeaways were is that we're not spending enough money on mental health, and certainly not enough to keep up for demand with services. The money we are spending does not include enough resources for community-based services. The length of stays in the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and the community behavioral health hospitals have become too long because there are too few discharge options available. The counties are paying lots of money for stays in Anoka, and the CBHs that do not meet the hospital level of care, and that money disappears into the general fund. We need more collaboration between stakeholders, and maybe some new funds might help jumpstart that process. So what does this bill do? The first initiative is the creation of a mental health grant program, front-loaded with $10 million and for 2018 grants, $5 million for the 7-county metropolitan area and $5 million for outside the 7-county metro area. Department of Human Services will administer the grant application and approval process, Entities eligible to apply for the grant include a county in Minnesota, a hospital in Minnesota other than those operated by the state, a community mental health center, and we also added tribes in that amendment that you just adopted. The preference for the grant awards will be given for project proposals that involve more than one community stakeholder organization, because truly the idea behind this grant is to work on that continuity of care and making sure that we are getting people to get the right treatment at the right time. The second part of the bill is reallocating the money the counties currently pay for stays at Anoka and the community behavioral health hospitals that do not need a hospital level of care from the general fund into this grant fund program. So we feel that this money that counties are currently paying need to stay in the mental health system. So the bill calls for establishing a special revenue fund beginning July 1st, 2017, with the county payments being redirected. This money is to be used for grant awards made in 2018 for 2019 program execution. And Mr. Chair, at your discretion, I have Dr. Suter here to provide some additional testimony.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Suter. Please introduce yourself and proceed with any testimony you'd like to give.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for having me here today. My name is Dr. Bruce Suter. I'm a psychiatrist at Mayo Clinic. I serve as the clinical practice chair for psychiatry and psychology at Mayo, not just Mayo Rochester, but also for the health system sites throughout the state of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And I also had the opportunity to serve on the governor's task force this past year, along with Senators Rosen and Lori, Representative Clark Johnson, and of course Representative Peterson, where I too learned a lot, and I think we all really did learn from each other and with each other. You know, what I really like about this proposal is not just focusing on what happens within our state operated hospitals, but also what happens in the community hospitals, as well as the preventive aspects of what can happen with this money. I think that right now we do not do a good enough job of having resources available for people leaving hospitals, including the CDHH hospitals and Anoka, but also the community hospitals. But the piece that I really want to emphasize is how the preventive services that keep people from becoming that ill and requiring hospitalization, requiring these long emergency department stays as they await a bed, are really where the rubber hits the road in terms of where we can make an impact. We're not going to build our way out of this problem by building more inpatient beds, but if we can provide the infrastructure within the communities, and the communities then having the ability to be able to write the grants for what they need. Rochester's needs are different than Crookston's. Rochester's needs are different than those of my old hometown of Marshall, Minnesota. And what I like about this is it allows not a centralized plan from the state saying this is what you'll do, but really allowing local, regional places to be able to solve their own problems with the because they understand what those problems are. So with that, that's really what we wanted to emphasize today.
Thank you, Dr. Suter. Questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I did have a chance to talk with Representative Peterson. I really appreciate her leadership on this, and I think that it's a problem that the administration has acknowledged, counties have acknowledged, mental health advocates have acknowledged, and we need to step up because it's not getting better the way we've been approaching it to date, and I look forward to continuing to work with her. I think one of the things that would strengthen the bill is to strengthen the role of counties. So our in-state statute is the Mental Health Authority. They're actually given responsibility for planning, doing a gaps analysis, so they've already gathered the data about what, you know, shortcomings there are in their area. They've been working with the stakeholders in their area, and to really step up. And they're the ones who, quite honestly, have been wrestling with this the longest. I know my county alone is spending $13 million annually now in property tax dollars for people who are ready to be discharged from Anoka, but for whom there aren't local facilities or support services yet there. And we know, as Dr. Suter said, that if we can get ahead of it, we can actually help people from disintegrating to the point that they need Anoka level of services. And so it's my hope that as this moves along, we can continue to refine this, strengthen the partnerships and the sharing of knowledge that already exists. I do really would like us to encourage, and we'll be working with Representative Peterson and other stakeholders to really push the concept that part of this be redirecting some of that currently collected property tax dollars that go into the general fund, because not $1 of that is developing services or helping solve this problem. And I'm afraid that a competitive grant process will mean at least a 2-year, if not a 2.5-year delay before we see any change. It takes a while for DHS to hire staff, and then they have to develop criteria, and they give counties 6 months to respond or other stakeholders, and then they have to go through a selection process, and all of a sudden you're out 2 years without any change. And I'm thinking we can accelerate this a little bit faster. I think there's projects that are ready to go, but they just don't have resources. So I just wanted to let people know that I really appreciate this bill. I really appreciate the work of the Mental Health Task Force and the others who are working to problem solve. And I'm hoping we can accelerate this in some way so we start to see some results earlier.
All right, other questions? Seeing no other questions, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 737? Seeing none, final thoughts, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Representative Laffa that this is a collaborative process, and I had a meeting with the members of counties and other stakeholders yesterday, and we were also talked about some other language that we think we could incorporate to make the bill even just a little bit better and maybe give that clarifying language to the department. And if communities are already ready to go, that's terrific. That's wonderful news. But some of the pieces that we talked about was sustainability. And I think that as we look at these grants, we have to maybe give that seed money to redesign what our mental health system looks like, but we want to make sure that this is something that can continue with hopefully just existing resources or maybe even doing this better, smarter, faster, stronger, all that fun stuff. And I just want to thank everyone in the committee for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Thank you, Dr. Suter. House File 737, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Next up, we have Representative Zerwas and three bills. First, House Files 518, 102, and 103. And Representative Zerwas can move those bills in any order that he likes as he's making his way down.
Mr. Chair and members, we'll move House File 518.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 518 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. I understand there's an A1 author's amendment. Representative Zerwas, the A1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's an A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape for today. I would move the A1 amendment.
Representative Zerwas moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Are there questions for the A1 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas to House File 518 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 518 is the pediatric home care complex level of care nursing bill to create a complex level of home care nursing for pediatric patients 0 to 22 years old. This bill has been around before, and it's back before us again. What this bill would allow is a 25% rate increase for nurses to be paid in the home care setting, and that 25% bump would help with recruiting of nurses and try to compete with the nurses' shortage. Quite frankly, companies like Pediatric Home Services are competing against hospitals in which an ICU-level nurse would be working with multiple patients, working with a physician as a backstop, and have other colleagues around, and we're asking them to transition into providing the care in a family's living room or in their home. And that can be a pretty challenging and stressful change and hard to recruit and retain nursing staff. currently there's a shortage in this instance, and so that requires patients that could be taken care of at home to stay longer in the ICU and stay longer in the hospital. This keeps families apart. And for patients that are on public programs, it incurs significant costs and additional costs to MA. We know that for patients that are transferred home and taken care of in their home, we can do that care cheaper than if it was done in the intensive care unit. We have several testifiers, Mr. Chair, and so with that, I think I'll turn it over to Judy Gill, Pediatric Home Services Chief Clinical Officer.
Ms. Gill, welcome to the committee. If you could just name, recognize yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Judy Gill. I am Chief Clinical Officer for Pediatric Home Service. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to testify in support of HF 518. This bill addresses the shortage of home care nurses in Minnesota, specifically addressing the critical shortage of pediatric nursing in home care. The shortage is due in large part because reimbursement rates for home care nursing are so much lower than wages and benefits that hospitals and long-term care facilities can provide and offer nurses. By designating complex pediatric home care nursing as a separate category of home care nursing, we're acknowledging the growth in the clinical skills and medical advances since the home care nursing statute was last updated in the 1990s. In addition, there's been steady growth in the complex pediatric population over the last decade, and we expect that that trend will continue over the next decade. These children go from neonatal intensive care units and pediatric intensive care units in a hospital one day to their home the next day. The level of medical technology and highly skilled care that these nurses provide in the home would surprise many people. But we all agree that having these children in a safe care environment in their home is preferable to a hospital. They belong at home. Our focus is in resolving the significant and growing gap in access to home care nursing for families of medically complex children. I'd like to tell you a little bit about what that means to the neonatal intensive care units and pediatric intensive care units. You'll hear testimony from two families who are impacted. And then you will hear testimony from Dr. Maynard, finally, about a current multi-site study measuring the impact of the lack of available nursing. As a result of information entered so far, we anticipate an offset to the fiscal note and the cost incurred by this bill of about $6 million annually. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Becca Wurgler.
Ms. Wurgler, welcome to the committee. If you could just repeat your name for the record and then give us your testimony.
Hi, I'm Becca Wurgler. I have a five-year-old daughter named Claire. She was born with spina bifida. Because of spina bifida, she has multiple other medical conditions, which require her to have home care nursing. She has a tracheostomy tube, uses a ventilator at night, among many other medical things that she requires. She has nursing at home every day, all the time, 18 hours a day. The reason for this nursing is, number one, as parents, we can't do it all. We can't stay up at night, and we can't function during the day without sleep. I can tell you the nurses go to school with her. She's in kindergarten right now, thriving in kindergarten and at home. She has to have a nurse with her to go to school. If there is no nurse available because the nurse got sick or there's staffing, she cannot go to school, even if she's healthy. So it impacts her public learning. And her cognitive ability is extremely high for her age. Something that happens frequently, unfortunately, with home care is that we have nurses that get sick. They have sick kids. there's staffing issues that happen, and that means sometimes we don't have night nurses, which means my husband and I have to stay up all night. We then have to be up the next day, and we hope that we get a nurse anytime soon. But there's been times where it's been 36 to 48 hours without a nurse, and I can tell you it's exhausting as a parent. Because of that, my husband works full-time. He's not able to go to work. I am in school to become a nurse, and that affects my grades, completely affects my grades. We also have a 9-year-old daughter, and it uproots our family so much when we don't have that other person to help us through all of the cares that she requires. The other thing that's important about these nurses is they're in your home, and it's it sounds invasive for a lot of people, but it's truly part of our family. They become part of our family. But I have to trust them that they can take care of my child in an emergency situation. So if something happens, they need proper training. They need to completely act by themselves with no one else there to help them in an emergency, and that might be resuscitating a child. There's no doctor, there's no other nurse, there's no one else to help them. It's just them. It is a tough job, and it's vital for our family and us to be productive members of society to have a nurse in our home, have them trained, and have them stay. Because as much at training that they get when they come to your home, it's also getting used to Claire. It's also getting used to how our family works and how we get things done. It's a good 6 months until that nurse feels and Claire feels like there's a relationship between them. And sometimes we lose them after another 6 months. A lot of the times we do. So there's constant turnover. For a 5-year-old to have to be used to having multiple caregivers and seeing them go off all the time is something that I wish she didn't have to see. I wish there was more longevity with our nurses for her. We have some diamonds in the rough, but they're not. They're few and far between. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
And I'd like to introduce Rachel Erickson, another parent of a medically complex child.
Ms. Erickson, welcome to the committee. You can just please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rachel Erickson, and it's my first time ever doing this, so bear with me. April of last year, I had twins at 23 weeks gestation. Ethan spent 8 months in the hospital, and my daughter spent another 370s. I was told in August that it would take a while to get nursing. My son spent 60 days in the unit of intensive care unit, deteriorating, waiting for home care nursing. The system has failed us. My son was treated like an orphan and let to sit in that NICU. He ended up with multiple staph infections, which required multiple antibiotics once again. Nurses, nurse practitioners, and neonatologists all told me I need to get him out of here. What was I supposed to do? They said the longer a child sits in that NICU, he becomes, in quote, weird. 8 months of being in there, it was time to leave. With my previous experience in life, I pulled Medicaid reimbursement rates for long-term for RN visits, and I was floored. How can a company like PHS even afford to keep nursing? For the experience and the quality that you need to take care of someone like Easton at home, you can't hire them. You're going to get new grads, you need experience. You're not going to get someone from Children's Hospital, from Abbott, that has experience to go work in home care. The long-term developmental effects of Easton and Isabella are unclear. The one thing that we do know is extensive hospitalization stays plays a role with developmental milestones. The longer you're in the hospital, the more PT-OT speech therapy you will need to hit these milestones. With extra therapy provided, this will cost Medicaid more money in the long run. I have a letter from Gillette, from our neurologist, that she had wrote in support because I was arguing with our insurance carrier to get home-skilled nursing visits for Isabella when she was at home. And our neurologist stated, I am writing in support of in-home-skilled nursing visits for frequent evaluation of her respiratory nutritional status. By reducing her visits to pediatric clinics, her exposure to sick contacts will be limited. She is particularly vulnerable to infections, and serious infections require possible hospitalizations would be detrimental to her developmental progress. By providing frequent evaluations of her respiratory status and growth parameters, changes to her treatment plan can be adjusted more precisely and prevent significant deviations from her desired direction of growth and improve pulmonary health, which are vital to brain growth. There is also in the primary care practitioner guidelines, toddler development delays after extensive hospitalization, that really talks about physical and motor development delays. Motor development may be limited during an extensive hospital stay with confinement to a single room and restrictions in exploring and experiencing new sensory and environmental stimuli. The developing child has less physical space to practice growth and fine motor skills, fewer opportunities for educational play, and offer overwhelming, painful, and frightening sensory stimuli such as loud noises, medical procedures, rigid schedules, and altered sleep-wake cycles. Cognitive developmental delays. The stress in early childhood physically alters the pattern of brain waves, as detected by EEG. Stress is associated with decreased connections in the learning and memory center of the brain. Children born before 37 weeks have the dual challenge of a less developed brain coupled with reduced potential for brain growth due to hospitalization stress. Easton sat in that NICU for 60 days waiting on nursing. Why? It's unacceptable. I'm here today. I told PHS 2 days before because I'm floored. I would think the price that Medicaid would reimburse a neonatal intensive care unit compared to home care nursing, it has to be 2 or 3 times the amount. And then in the long run, I looked for studies last night. I was up till 6 a.m. trying to find something that would say by the age of 18, how much more every day that a child is stuck in that neonatal intensive care unit instead of home, to say this is how much it will cost. 95% of these kids are on Medicaid. So ultimately, this will cost Medicaid in the long run, when we can get them out sooner. So I just ask that you all look at PHS's bill and really take a careful look at it. You know, it's watching your child think they're going to die and 20% chance of survival. And they make it, and they're thriving, and we're fortunate. Easton probably will get his trach out this summer. We're lucky. We're one of the lucky families. I can't imagine others, what they have to go through. 3 nights ago, I just had an emergency at 2:30 in the morning. We had to have an ambulance come pick us up because my son's trach couldn't get through. The nurse was there. I couldn't do it. I have his twin sister as well at home. I have blood and pus coming out of his trach. He can't breathe. He's choking. The nurse is manually bagging him. We get into the ER. We go right from 2:30 until 8:30 in the morning. We have to wait for the ENT doctor to appear. His trach hole was closing. She said, there's no way I could have got it in. She had to pry his hole back open to put a trach in to get him to come home. If I didn't have nursing, who's to say Easton would be here today? That's about all I have.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience that would... I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Maynard.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Dr. Roy Maynard. I've practiced as a pediatric subspecialist in Minnesota since I finished my residency at the University of Minnesota in 1984. I'm board certified in newborn intensive care medicine. I'm also board certified in pediatric pulmonary medicine, although I just a few months ago retired from both of those clinical practices. I'm also an executive committee member for the American Academy of Pediatric Sexual and Home Care, and I'm also a medical director for Pediatric Home Service. This problem of not getting kids out of the hospital is not unique to Minnesota. This is happening across the country. I think you have the copy of the article I wrote for the American Academy of Pediatric News, which was published in December, about the study I'm just about to tell you about. This population is also increasing. The trajectory is not slowing down. There's going to be more of these kids coming into our community. We need to address this problem. So a year ago, I approached the 4 major children's hospitals in the state and said, are you having a problem getting kids discharged because of the lack of home care nurses to staff these kids, who most of which are technology dependent? The answer was yes. All 4 hospitals agreed to collaborate together. Competing children's hospitals agreed to collaborate to study this problem. We're almost done with the study. The most recent data which you have is 10 months into the study. What we did was we asked the discharge planners to track children who would be going home with nurses, identify the day they were medically ready for discharge. They should be home. If they're not home, I want to know the number of days they stay beyond that and the reasons. So the numbers of children are small. 20 out of 42 kids going home for the first time with home care nurses have delayed discharges. But the number of hospital days, the impact on hospital days, tying up beds that could be available for other children, and the cost to the system is incredible. So far, we're over 1,000 days of children sitting in a hospital who don't need to be there, waiting for home care nurses to help staff them at home. If the cost were only $5,000 a day, that's over $5 million. And I can guarantee you we're lowballing this because I'm not including hospitals like Hennepin County, St. Mary's Duluth, St. Cloud, who do send home technology-dependent children. And if parents check a little box on the admission records that says, I do not want my child's medical records reviewed for any purposes, I can't include that data in my study. So it's very clear the hospitals are getting backed up. Kids are waiting to be discharged. We can't get them home. The technology-dependent kids need home care nurses to help staff them. You already heard testimony from these parents, and I think we need to address this issue.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lieb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Meaner, thank you very much. I just had a thought while you were presenting, and I wonder if you could just react to this. You know, in the area of just hospitalization generally, over the years, hospital stays have gotten shorter. And I think a lot of that is that we've changed our incentives that hospitals get. Payments, hospitals stop getting paid at a certain point. And then they need to get people out. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes hospitals are absorbing costs after that point and so on. And with what you were just describing, I'm just wondering, in this area, whether the hospitals have stepped forward to try to help solve the problem or whether our financial incentives are just so misaligned here that there'd be no reason for them to do so. Do you understand where I'm going with this? Because I understand, I think we all understand that, you know, the problem and that what the bill is here to solve is the problem of not being able to hire enough highly skilled nurses to do it. But I just wonder about the role of the hospital in making this happen, because obviously there's a system problem here that impacts everybody, and we need to make sure that everybody has the incentive to solve the problem who might be useful in solving the problem.
Dr. Maynard.
Mr. Chairman and members, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, the first step was to identify the magnitude of this problem. And I can tell you, when I met with representatives from all four of the major children's hospitals and asked them, is this the elephant in the room? Everybody said, yes, it is. But nobody could grasp what's it cost the system. And I can tell you this, the hospitals don't share their financial issues with me. But I think they all understand it was a big enough problem. They were willing to collaborate. And all of this data goes into an encrypted website. It all went through an institutional review board. I don't see any patients' names. I'm not directly involved with the discharge planners. So we are going to get information, I think, depending on the study ends in about 3 more months. Then we'll be able to go back to each of the hospitals and see what are some of the alternatives. And there are some alternatives. It's too complicated getting here, but there are some alternatives.
Ms. Gill, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Chairman and Representative Lieblum. I'd like to say that what an additional complication is, as we take nurses and train them intensively to be able to care for these complex children in the home, they become suddenly quite attractive to staffing hospitals. So we've had an added component that complicates the factors of spending all of this time and money and resources training to lose them within 6 months to a year or a little over a year to hospitals because they become suddenly very attractive. So there is a conflict there, and the hospitals also need staff, so I understand that. And I don't know of any way to try and come to an agreement to say you can only have so many of them.
Mm-hmm. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just I mean, I think that the problem, definitely this is a problem, and I think it's a system problem. Mm-hmm. This committee and the other HHS committees, we hear a lot about what you just described in other contexts, too. You know, nursing facilities can't keep aides because they get hired by hospitals and so on. And, you know, this is a problem in an era of labor shortage, where this is even outside of healthcare, it's a tremendous problem. But in other areas, I know that there have been collaborative efforts to deal with the system problem here. We were just talking about it in terms of mental health, where just this bill we just heard about, the way the state has tried to deal with the problem of people sitting at our Anoka hospital that don't need to be there is to make the counties pay for it, to give the counties an incentive to get them out of there. Well, that only works if the counties have a place to put them. So it's a really similar problem, and I wonder if, besides just raising the rates, which, you know, I agree that that's something that probably really does need to happen, whether there's more that should be done to try to solve the system problem, especially if there's an overall shortage of people who have these kinds of skills. Just popping into my head is the idea that, you know, if hospitals had a financial incentive to get the people, to get the children out, that maybe they would lend or share personnel or help to train the personnel, or I don't know. I don't want to get a bunch of fearful hospitals coming to me and saying, oh, my God, what did you just say we should do? But you know what I'm saying. There should be a way for stakeholders to get together and think of this as a system. And I hope that can happen. Maybe that's something that DHS should take the lead on, to have some kind of stakeholder group where we can say, you know, let's look at this a little bit more broadly than just, you know, we increase payment on this side, and then we have to increase it on this side, and, you know, it's helpful, but it's not the answer.
Ms. Gill?
Thank you, and thank you for those comments. I can tell you that only yesterday, I took a phone call from a nurse that is a bedside nurse in the University of Minnesota Masonic Children's Hospital in the neonatal intensive care unit. And she said, I just am wondering, what are you doing about this? We have 6 children that are in here. We are closed. We cannot take any more infants in the neonatal intensive care unit because we have 6 children holding beds here that are waiting for home care nursing. And what can you do about that? And the immediate reaction is, I can't give what we don't have. And however, I would like to reassure representatives here in this committee that we are working through the Minnesota Home Care Association. We continue to have dialogue with hospitals regarding the issue and the challenges. We have to commit and ensure we have adequate staffing before we can accept a client to go home. It would be devastating to these children if this is the riskiest time for them, is right at discharge from the hospital to the home. So it would be devastating for them to have partial staff. And in fact, that's what's happening now. There are companies that will say, yes, we can do a soft open or take this child home, but there are going to be gaps in shifts. And what happens is an event happens, not unlike what Rachel Erickson just spoke about with her son, and those children are immediately readmitted into the hospital without adequate staffing. So I want to reassure everyone we are working diligently system-wide to try and address these issues, but it is not an immediately solvable situation. However, one, the resolving the discrepancy in pay would really be a major step to allow us to do some retention with some of these nurses instead of losing them after a short year or so.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to be
be a co-author on this bill. I have a police officer in Mankato that has taken, I think, the extraordinary step of building a house around a hospital room that they had designed for their daughter. And now they're having trouble getting the nurses to staff it. I believe they got a couple that have been with them and stayed with them much through their own financial hardship, but because they can't find anybody else, then those nurses end up doing a long period of time for them. They're very devoted to their daughter and have done everything they can possibly do to help out, but we need to raise the rates. There's just no two ways about it. To the woman with twins, I found your testimony extremely hard, and I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Representative Branson.
Hi, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm wondering if I can get Rachel Erickson back up. Thank you.
Welcome back, Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Rachel. Rachel and I went to high school together. Yeah. And I was texting Christy about you being here, and she says you're a baby mama on fire. So, and yes, and Rachel is
my Instagram.
Yes, so Rachel is a baby mama on fire, and she has an Instagram account where she chronicles each and every day of her twins' journey, micro preemie mom. So, if you're interested, check that out. Rachel, could you? I know that you were a very successful woman, in outside the workforce. And or in the workforce there, and you worked for corporate America, traveled a lot, and could you just tell us a little bit about where you are now?
Yep. So, thank you, Representative Branson. Previously, I had been in the revenue financial world. I understand hospital contracting, reimbursement rates. I had worked in pharmacy. I had worked for Walgreens Home Infusion as a regional project financial manager. So I traveled for 5 years across the U.S. dealing with Medicaid rates, contracts, due diligence, acquisitions. So I completely understand when it comes to nursing and home care because I dealt with it 5 years ago on the home infusion side. Then recently I worked for a large work comp company in Minneapolis managing a staff of about 30 RNs. I learned a lot about the ambulatory surgery side, the provider side, the hospital side, everything here in Minnesota. I had a six-figure year income that I had to quit. In June, we will be out of money. We had to totally get out of our house with Easton coming home. We had to pull every piece of carpeting out of our house. We had a private benefit. We got an air purifier installed. We have dogs. I mean, you name it. We can't have chemicals. We can't have anything that will distress the airway. So when it talks about the financial burden, in June, I am thinking what I can do from home, calling in favors to everyone I know across the U.S. to see what I could do because my bills have to be paid. I can't file bankruptcy because I'm going to need another car. My car is, I've got a two-door coupe Mercedes. Who the heck can put twins in that? Mm-hmm. You know, who can even take Easton's 50 bags with us when we go to a visit? I didn't plan for this. I had daycare lined up, everything, and my twins came early, and this is how we deal with it. And now it's a matter of, this is life. This is becoming a, first off, it's a mother, or not even a mother. I am a nurse because my kid's screaming in pain from 3 hernias from a failure to thrive surgery and from 3 to 6 o'clock at night. And I can no longer be a mother. I have to be a medical professional and not feel guilty. Then all of a sudden it's advocate because I'm arguing with insurance companies, which I understand the process, and I'm extremely frustrated. And on Instagram this past week, 3 parents in other states have reached out to me whose child had to have a tracheostomy and asked me for guidance on what they're supposed to do. One was in Texas, North Carolina, and Florida, asking for advice of what equipment they're going to need. How are they supposed to set up their house when they have no room? I have sent pictures. I deal with this stuff. People have followed me online. It is a life-altering, basically, event that happens. They're here, they're thriving, and I know that this break will come out. So I am very fortunate. I can say I don't feel sorry for us. We'll make it. Things happen for a reason, and it happened to us, so I can be the voice to try to make change. If my kids were healthy, believe me, I would be in D.C. thinking of what I could do. This is something that as PHS was stating, this is not something just in Minnesota. There were months for a wait in Ohio. I know actually a person here who had a child at 24 weeks. Because she did not get home nursing services or anything, her child was rehospitalized three times. In December 29th, at 11 months old, he got a trach. 11 months old, he had to get a trach. And December 29th, and she was waiting until April to get discharged out of Children's Hospital for nursing. So, and I know for a fact they are on medical assistance. So that whole time, how many months she's sitting in there, medical assistance is paying, how much money compared to being actually at home with the developmental, just at 11 months old, the brain development, you have to get them home. I think that's where I am. So now I've become an advocate as long as I have nurses.
Any follow-up, Representative Friend? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too want to thank the moms for their testimony, and Representative Zoros for bringing this forward, and Pediatric Home Services for the care that you and the nurses provide. I had a question about billing and payment. I guess this is to the bill's author, to Pediatric Home Services. I notice in the final section of the bill, the 2.15, 2.18, that of the increase, 10% goes for training and 80% goes for pay and benefits for the nurses. And was wondering about that remaining 10%, and kind of if you can just explain what happens with that and the justification for that.
Ms. Veal.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representative. You know, what remains then is the infrastructure, the cost of doing the prior authorization with insurance, the cost of billing and collecting, the cost associated with staffing and scheduling patients. So it's not as though you just hire a nurse and then a nurse gets assigned. Those nurses have to get scheduled in. We need to understand what the families desire for hours are and their preferred dates and times. So, you know, do you want coverage, more coverage on nights during the week, and then perhaps less coverage on nights on the weekends when you're available? So all of that is incorporated in the cost. It's not just the wages and benefits we pay to our nurses. It takes a team and a highly devoted team to try and accomplish what sometimes seems like staffing cases with very, very limited resources.
Follow-up, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just thinking about ways in which that would be more complicated for in a pediatric setting versus an adult. And I suppose there might be in terms of the overnights and some of the scheduling and things, and then increasing number of nurses. Can you just comment on that piece? Because I'm just trying to think of how that would be different for this versus the adult home care side of things.
Ms. Gill.
Thank you. Thank you. It's probably not as different, although perhaps the level of training is a little different. When these children are discharged, they're being discharged from intensive care units. So generally, as the disabled or the disability community ages, they're able to do more self-directed care. It's not to say they don't require the care, because they most certainly do, but they have the input and the ability to influence scheduling. In some cases, they're able to hire their own workers, and they coordinate that scheduling. Usually, as you heard from the testimony from our two families here, and they're representative of many of our families, is they're so overwhelmed with the change. They didn't expect to bring home a child this complex. So they're so overwhelmed with trying to understand the medical system, trying to understand hospitals, trying to understand insurance and finance, etc., that they're really not capable of managing, or not ready yet to start managing some aspects of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess relatedly, too, I was going to ask about the age cutoff of age 22, because it makes sense that for young kids, of course, it would be much more complicated. And I deal with this work, actually, I work on issues of sexual exploitation. And there's this issue of kind of what's, you know, so a 21-year-old versus a 23-year-old, you know, and thinking that there's this big, drop in rate if this goes through. caring for a 21-year-old and 11 months versus a 22-year-old and 1 month. So can you just comment, I guess, per what you said, too, as kids get older, I'm just wondering whether a younger age would make sense, or sort of just can you comment on that side of things versus the really little kids that we've been hearing about?
Ms. Gill.
Thank you. Yes, I can speak a little on that. We don't think that, I want to make sure that everyone understands our predominant experiences with pediatrics, so that's why we've addressed this in this capacity. It's not to say that adults, once they turn 22, they don't require those intensive services. We hope that this bill is the first step in trying to reconcile the discrepancies in pay for home care nursing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Representative Pinto.
So I guess maybe just the final point on that, then, is that I gather from what you've said that there probably is a gradual decrease in intensity and need for complexity. I mean, obviously, this is an average. It's going to vary depending on the family as the child gets older, so that, again, somebody who's 18, 19, 20, 21 may have very complicated needs, but in general, that pool is going to be not nearly as complicated as the really little kids that we've been hearing about. And so just, I guess, any final comment on that piece? I wonder if that might just be helpful as we're looking at this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Dr. Maynard.
Some of these diseases are life-limiting. So a substantial portion of these children, depending upon the underlying disease, may not survive to 21. And I think when you look at the community of pediatric providers, we extrapolate, we were kind of in training, we went up to age 18, but now we're dealing with pediatric diseases that are living longer. The adult physicians aren't very comfortable with those, so we extend our time out to 21. And it's, I think, kind of a similar situation for the pediatric nurses, extending it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I have a question about the fiscal note, and I'm not sure who would be the right one to answer it, but we did an amendment at the beginning that took out the language from the bill about adjusting the payment rates for managed care and county-based purchasing, and I assume that affects the fiscal note. And I don't know, that's going to, of course, reduce the cost. First of all, I wanted to ask, this goes back to our whole thing about it's really, we have a lot of difficulty making sure that that happens. I get that. But I'm also assuming that some of these situations, the family will be covered by managed care. And so I'm wondering how that's going to happen and then how the fiscal note will be impacted by that change.
Representative Liebling, I think agency has Ms. Erber in the audience. If she could approach the testifier table and elaborate on the effect that the amendment has to the bill. Representative Liebling, would you like to redirect the question to Ms.
Yeah,
Erber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm just wondering, since we made this amendment to the bill and took out the increasing in the payment rates for managed care and county-based purchasing, how that gets reflected in this fiscal note, which included, it was based on the original bill.
Ms. Erber, welcome to the committee.
Hi, Mr. Chair members. My name is Carrie Erber with DHS. So basically on with the amendment, it would remove the admin costs for the FTEs for the Healthcare Administration and the Community Supports Administration. The managed care costs would still be in here because we would still allocate, through the rates, the managed care. However, the managed care plans would not have to necessarily allocate that money to their employees. So, the costs would remain the same. We are looking at what the effective date, if it would move back or not. So that part I'd have to get back to you on. But, the costs would still include managed care.
Oh, thank you,
Mr.
Chair. Why, Representative Zerwes and I are looking at each other, and, I don't want to have to give my speech again. But, boy, here it is again. Here it is again. So I understand what the testifier just said. So when we remove that portion, we no longer have to have more staff at DHS to make sure they do it. And they may or may not do it, but we're putting the money in there anyway. And just we'll just cross our fingers and hope they decide to raise the rates for the people that are under their control, I guess. I don't know how much of this would be affected by that, but I don't know. I don't know how we get around that. I just don't know. Maybe Representative Zerwas, he looks like he has something to say about it.
Representative Zerwas.
I wish I had something better to say about it. No, I share your frustration, Representative Liebling. I think Ms. Keel could give a little bit of insight on how the building of the building through managed care is occurring now and what she expects to occur if the amended language is placed in the law. So I don't know.
Ms. Gill.
Thank you. We hope to aggressively work with the managed care organizations to explain that we're very well aware, should this bill pass and be implemented, that we're very well aware that the rates were adjusted to the managed care organizations and that we expect those rates to pass through to the home care nursing segment of that. Additionally, I wanted to note that the fiscal note really doesn't have any offset that we anticipate occurring. And I spoke to it very briefly earlier when I was talking about Dr. Maynard's and the multi-site study, that this identified the ongoing delayed discharge study conducted over 10 months showed 1,055 days of unnecessary hospitalizations due to lack of home care nursing. This equates to 1,266 days in a one-year period. Comparing, in a conservative estimate, comparing hospital costs for 1,266 days is $7.6 million. Comparing the hospital cost of $7.6 million to the cost of caring for these patients at home at the increased rate would amount to $1.6 million. So that results in what we see as a $6 million savings. It's not reflected in the fiscal note.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, of course, we on the committee know that a lot of times the fiscal note process just doesn't reflect all of that. So, you know, but thank you for that. We're there's no doubt that getting somebody out of the hospital saves money almost every time. I did want to ask another piece of this, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gill talked about the question was about the 80%, 10%, 10%. And, you know, I have to say I'm not really satisfied with your answer, Ms. Gill, because I don't see that increasing the rates increases the work that you're doing. And maybe I'm wrong about that. But you're basically were explaining that 10% would go to administrative overhead, and we all understand there's administrative overhead. But this is a bill about increasing the rate. It doesn't. Presumably, you're already, doing this work. Now, maybe this would increase the number of people you'd be able to serve, and so on. But even so, you know, presumably right now you're getting a rate that a portion of which goes to your overhead. So, if we're going to allocate this money, which I certainly hope we can, I would like to see it go to the, you know, certainly training, I understand that too, but I'd like to see more of it go to the actual rate increase for the people who are going to be hired rather than to administrative overhead.
Ms. Gill.
Thank you very much for your comments, Representative Liebling. I understand what you're saying, and yes, we do currently provide those services, and really what we're looking for is to be able to continue to provide those services and cover it. So I think the important aspect is that the bulk of the increase is going to the wages and the benefits for these home care nurses. And if that number needs to be adjusted, I'm not in opposition, because it's all about being able to compensate and pay these nurses and retain these nurses so that they can continue to provide the level of care that these children require.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Zerwas and the committee, right? I know that we're in the finance division of the committee, and we are talking about the cost of this and sort of the dilemma of what happens to families when their loved ones, whether they're pediatric cases like we're describing today or others, are stranded in a hospital because there's no place for them to go. And I think one of the important points that Ms. Erickson made is the risk that people face when they're in the hospital for too long. And we can only imagine, and we could calculate quickly the cost of that duration of a hospital stay, even though it might be, you know, the only choice, and we're bearing that cost together as taxpayers. But I think the important point that that twin mom made is that the well-being of her son and her daughter would be enhanced if the care were happening at home. And we're talking a lot about the cost of this and making sure we're able to fund it, but I don't want to lose the thread of the importance of the care and the well-being of those kids or other loved ones who get stuck in a hospital when they can't get to the place where they should get their care. And I, as a nurse myself, and now my daughter is a nurse taking care of kids at Masonic Children's Hospital, the hospital is an important place, and we need strong, well-functioning hospitals across the state of Minnesota. But you don't want to be there any longer than you need to because they are not safe places, not because people aren't safe, but because of what happens there. So we want people discharged, and it's oftentimes safer to be cared for at home, and home, especially for a young child or neonate, that home is the place where they're going to develop and get on into their lives, right, with their family. So there are a lot of layers to this piece of legislation, and there are a lot of reasons why it's important, but for the well-being of Minnesotans who have been sick, and Representative Zerwas, you can attest to this yourself in your own life. Let's not lose the important point about the care that's being delivered and where it's being delivered and what that means for the well-being of the people. Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm a co-author, and I find this bill to be very important. I would like to also, though, just throw out that there's a number of other people that provide services in homes, home health aides. They also are grossly underpaid and have the same issues. They can't find people that are willing to do it anymore. I do have a bill that addresses that, and I'm hoping to get Representative Zerwas to sign on to that. Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the testifiers for coming and sharing their stories. I find it very frustrating when we hear these stories where we can make a difference here in the legislature by prioritizing where we spend money. And when people advocate so strongly for issues that we have solutions for, but then we don't solve them. So my sense is that for me personally, I would prefer to fund higher reimbursement rates to caregivers and not reduce taxes on the wealthy in Minnesota. And if you feel the same way, I encourage you to advocate for prioritizing where we should be spending money.
Final thoughts, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, Representative Liebling, in talking to some of the advocates for the bill. If we're lucky enough to have this incorporated into the omnibus bill, certainly we can go to 90-10. I think just so everyone feels good about what we're doing here, I think that's the right thing to do. And so if we're able to move forward on this piece of legislation, I'll be sure to have an update to the language that reflects that. So we've talked a lot about the finances, and Dr. Maynard talked about the study that shows of over 1,000 days within 10 months of hospitalization where children were in the hospital solely because they couldn't be taken care of at home because there wasn't a nurse there to provide that complex level of pediatric care in the home. And that 1,000 days represents money, $5 or $6 million, that could offset a fiscal note that in our process isn't a dynamic fiscal note. But I have to echo what Representative Murphy said, in that this is the fiscal committee and this is what we talk about in finances. But I think the two testifiers today really showed the impact on families and on children. If the members, we can fund this, and we can do it at a pretty manageable cost when you factor in the savings. And we can do that in a financially responsible way, and we can do it in a way that's best for families. But what I would caution the committee is, and say is, this, along with MA spend down and a couple of the other bills that I have, the one thing that we can't do is take families with sick kids or poor disabled individuals and make them political objects and political footballs. And so if you prioritize that, you don't prioritize that. If you vote for that, you don't support that. These are huge issues. These are tough issues. They affect real families. They impact real people's lives every day. Let's just keep our heads down. Let's focus on the end. And let's do our job. With that, I'll renew the motion that House File 518 be laid over for possible inclusion in the chairman's bill.
House File 518, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you for your testimony. To your testifiers, Representative Zerwas. Representative Zerwas, you have two remaining bills. Which one you prefer to take first?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 102, the Intergovernmental Transfer Bill.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 102 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Zerwas, we have the bill before us. I understand that there is an author's amendment.
There is. Members, I think there are two amendments in your packet, but the A1 was adopted in a previous committee, and so it's just the A2 amendment that we need to move.
Members, I'll move the A2 amendment to... Well, Representative Zerwas, I'm sorry, I superseded you as the author.
Hey, if you want to move it, that's less work for me, but yeah. No, either way, let's move it.
Representative Zerwas, would you please move your author's amendment?
I will move my author's amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment is to get the bill in the shape of, for discussion today.
Any discussion to the A2 amendment, members? All those in favor, then, of adopting the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motions prevail, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. House File 102 is the Intergovernmental Transfer Bill. A few years ago, we worked to add a few large ambulance services to the IGT program. Now that the model is established at DHS, we offer this legislation to mid-sized governmental ambulance services to use the same program. The program allows the opportunity to leverage the underpayment for Medicaid by comparing the top 3 to 5 commercial payer rates with the Medicaid fee-for-service rate. Ambulance services that would potentially benefit would be Rice Memorial Ambulance in Wilmer, Burnsville Ambulance, Cloquet Ambulance, Virginia Ambulance, Hibbing Ambulance Service, Maplewood Ambulance Service, Woodbury Ambulance Service, and Cottage Grove. I would also like to offer, the amendment. And so with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I have Mr. Buck McAlpin from the Ambulance Association to answer any questions on House File 102.
Mr. McAlpin, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McAlpin on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I think Representative Zerwas did a good job. The amendment offered today was just a few weeks ago from DHS. Lots of private businesses bill for ambulance services, and this is just to clarify that Buck's pretty good billing company can't communicate directly with the state government. That has to be between government entities, and this just clarifies how the process comes into play. But as Representative Zerwas testified to in presenting the bill, is it's been a nice opportunity. St. Paul Fire and Hennepin County Ambulance have used this for 3 years now, and have been able to bring in some more money, and this is just another tool in our toolbox we use to try to generate some more revenue for our ambulance operations across the state.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify to this bill as amended? Anyone in the audience? Members. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and for either Representative Zerwas or Mr. McAlpin. I'm just looking at the language of the amendment and trying quickly to understand it in the context of the bill. So we're talking about the data and the funding transactions related to the payments shall be between the commissioner and the governmental entities. How is that data being treated? Is it public? Is it non-public? Is it private? Is it confidential?
Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment wouldn't change any of the data, which would be medical record billing information, which I assume is private data.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
And I appreciate the medical record data. It's the financial transactions data that we're just, where I was asking this question, right? Like, what can the legislature see after the fact so we understand the relationship between the legislature, the Department of Human Services, and the vendors.
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I believe under the Open Data Practices Act, they could access the City of St. Paul, for instance, billing data. The way it works now is any of the billing companies look at all the data for the entire year for the fee-for-service 911 population, look at the top five commercial payers, including the mileage and the base rate. When they come up with an average rate compared to the fee-for-service and the fee-for-service Medicaid rate, then that's sent over to the City of St. Paul Finance Department. So I believe at that point that finance, that total number, say $1 million for discussion purposes, we send over and they say, oh, we can leverage that match of $1 million from CMS. I believe at that point that, or at any point, that total amount would be available publicly, probably for Hennepin County and the city as public information.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was wondering why tribal governments are excluded. Maybe I missed that. I'm sorry. But it's on line 3.15.
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, in discussions with DHS when we put this together, the tribal governments are not allowed to leverage an IGT. They're paid differently from the government for ambulance transportation. So this was just to put in a statute to be sure that tribal governments couldn't leverage intergovernmental transfer, but it was a request from DHS.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Final comments, Representative Zero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I'll renew my motion for House File 102.
That being said, members, House File 102, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Zerwas, we have House File 103 to remain here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I'll move House File 103 be laid over or be considered for possible inclusion into the Chairman's bill. House File 103 is the ambulance Medicaid rate increase. Last session, we provided a 5% rate increase for outstate ambulance services. Those increases exclude the metro and communities like Rochester, Duluth, and St. Cloud. This legislative request would make the rate increase uniform across the state. And again, with me is Buck McAlpin from the Minnesota Ambulance Association.
McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, I think he covered it. We could stand for questions.
Members. Anyone from the audience would wish to testify on the bill? Members, Representative Considine?
It seems like all I've been doing is listening to you present bills. How many you got?
Representative Zerwas.
It's the Zerwas show.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, that is unnecessary, my friend. I am just here to help.
Oh, you're doing a great job.
Well, thank you, sir.
Members, any further questions? Final comments, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. With that, I'll renew my motion for House File 103.
Representative Zerwas renews his motion for House File 103 to be laid over to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Members, with that, our next meeting is tomorrow, Thursday, March 2nd, 2017. And with that, members, we are...